This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Tom Barry, has been writing about what he describes as the new face of imprisonment in America, immigration prisons along the border in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. In the late 90s, and then again after 9/11, new laws were enacted to crack down on illegal immigration. According to Barry, the number of immigrants in the criminal justice system has grown 400% in the past 4 years. This crackdown has led to the growth of immigrant prisons that are owned by local governments but operated by private corporations, financed publicly by tax-exempt bonds, and located in remote, depressed communities. Their remote locations makes these prisons and the prisoners invisible to most Americans. Barry visited 11 prison towns along the border over the course of 9 months. His report on how profits, poverty, and immigration converge in these prisons is published in the current edition of the Boston Review. Barry has researched immigration for the past 30 years. He's a senior analyst at the Center for International Policy, where he directs the Transborder Project. He writes the blog Borderlines. Tom Barry, welcome to Fresh Air. Many of the people who are in the prisons that you've been investigating are called criminal aliens. What does that mean?
Well, there isn't a real precise definition of criminal aliens. The general definition is that these are non-citizens who have committed crimes, either as immigrants who are illegal or legal immigrants that have committed crimes. However, the definition, the working definition, has expanded dramatically since 1996, when they added a whole new level of criminal violations that mean that a criminal violation is not only face criminal consequences for that, but then is deported. But more particularly since 2005, that simple border crossers, illegal border crossers, are now criminal aliens, and not just are deported, put over the border, but spend time in prison first before they're deported.
And what's the logic behind the decision stemming from 2005 to imprison people who have crossed the border illegally and then deport them as opposed to just deporting them?
Well, the standard line from the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security is that we're upholding the rule of law, that these people are breaking the law, they need to suffer the consequences. But if you look beyond that, the strategy behind it, they'll say just as clearly that this is a strategy of deterrence. We want to punish these people to send a message both to them, to their families, to people in Mexico and farther south, that they shouldn't come to the United States because they're going to be imprisoned, and imprisoned as long as 20 years. It's generally much less, but if you're across illegally a number of times, you could be in prison for 20 years simply because you're crossing the border illegally.
So was that filling a lot of our prisons now?
Yes. Both Bureau of Prisons and U.S. Marshals Service are complaining that there's a crisis, that they can't find places for all these criminal aliens, that it's growing, that the number of immigrants in the U.S. Marshals Service prisons and Bureau of Prisons is growing dramatically, 400% in the last 4 years. And to deal with that, what they do is create special prisons for criminal aliens so that they separate them from the general population. And part of the logic of that is that they're separated and they don't cause any trouble because they're not integrated with the general population. Immigrants have very few connections with lawyers. Generally, they're far away from their families in the United States. They're taken from states and brought to the far reaches of West Texas. And so that they're alone. It doesn't cause problems for the private companies that operate them or for the Bureau of Prisons. It's a very convenient system.
So there's basically like a new and growing separate justice system for criminal aliens.
Yes, that's right. There's a separate penal system, certainly. Previously, most immigrants who were picked up for crossing illegally were just put back across the border. They were not charged criminally. Now, in the last few years, since they're being charged criminally, they're transferred from the Department of Homeland Security, which is administrative. It doesn't address crime and punishment, to our Department of Justice, which deals with crime and punishment, so that increasing numbers of immigrants are go from ICE, the Department of Homeland Security, to our criminal justice and penal system.
So do they have their own lawyers?
They have lawyers. Unlike the immigration system, if you're part of the criminal justice system, that you have a right to a lawyer. You have a right to a court-appointed lawyer. However, they only get one lawyer, and this one lawyer is responsible for as many as 80 immigrants, actually never talks to these immigrants, has a paralegal come in and write up a little thing, and then meets them the first time on the day of the conviction and the sentencing. And they're convicted and sentenced en masse. That I've gone to a number of courts where you have 50, 60, 70 immigrants all being trooped into a courtroom, all in shackles, and all asked if they understand their rights and if they're guilty, and they all reply in unison, yes, and then they're escorted out of the prison and back to the private prison that they came from, that we wouldn't treat citizens this way.
The people in the prisons that you've been writing about are not just illegal immigrants who have illegally crossed over the border into the United States and are being imprisoned to be later deported. There's also a lot of legal immigrants who are in these prisons. On what grounds are they there?
They're there because since the mid-1990s, it has been written into immigration statutes something called aggravated felonies. If you are an immigrant, a legal immigrant, and you have been convicted of aggravated felony, then you are subject to mandatory detention and removal from this country. The term aggravated felony has nothing to do whether it's aggravated or little to do with whether it's aggravated or a felony, that these are generally minor charges. And what I've found in U.S. Marshals Service and Bureau of Prisons, generally these are small crimes, which are generally drug possession crimes. It's up to the discretion of Immigration Customs Enforcement to consider it or not an aggravated felony. Most times they consider any kind of crime that that immigrant does as an aggravated felony. Then they're subject to mandatory detention and removal, and this is happening frequently. It's now routine.
So are you saying basically, like, if you're caught, say, holding a small amount of marijuana, that could be an aggravated felony? If you're a legal immigrant, you could be sent to one of these prisons and then deported?
That's right. But it's even worse than that. If, as a young person, you were convicted of drug possession, only convicted. Generally, these people were not sentenced. They didn't serve any time in prison. But if they were convicted, it's on their record. So now, as the data systems are now being integrated between the Immigration Service and the FBI, these records are picked up so that any kind of identification check, whether it be a traffic stop or an airport security or even welfare, that it's discovered that you've had a past conviction. You've been here most of your life, that you can be picked up by immigration and detained and deported. This is happening routinely.
So in other words, you'd be deported for a crime that you were already convicted of in the past?
That's right. It's because of these new laws starting generally in the mid-1990s, yes, they're retroactive.
Is that considered double jeopardy?
It is double jeopardy, yes. That term is used quite often. And what has happened in the legal community is that they're seeing that this merger of the immigration system and the criminal justice system, it has created new responsibilities for lawyers, because lawyers will often say, well, you can plead this case and then, you know, get off. You're not going to serve any time. But if you plead and it's on your record as a 16-year-old, 17-, 18-year-old boy or girl, that it's on your record, even you never served time, and then 10 years later, they'll pick you up and take you away from your family, and you land up in a country you've never been to.
You call the prisons that you've been writing about part of a public-private prison complex. And it's a really unusual and kind of confusing mix of public and private, but that one that I think is really important to understand. And you describe this as the new face of imprisonment in America. So I'm going to ask you to explain this public-private relationship in the prisons.
The government, whether it be ICE, the Department of Homeland Security, or U.S. Marshals Service, or the Bureau of Prisons, they're not building any new prisons or detention centers. So what they have to do is when they have prisoners, and in this case, an explosion of prisoners that they're getting because of the immigrant crackdown, where to put them? They contract regularly with local governments, particularly in the Southwest, poor local governments that are interested in prisons as an economic development project. These local governments have no capacity to run a prison, but they have a capacity to raise municipal bonds to construct a prison. And then in that, when they arrange the financing, and they do this in consultation with the private prison industry, then they subcontract their responsibility to a private prison corporation to operate and manage the prison that they own. I've talked to wardens in two different occasions in these prisons, and they didn't know who owned the prison. It's remarkable, and they assume that their company owns the prison, but it's really owned by the county. And in this bizarre labyrinth of contracts and subcontracts, what's lost is accountability, transparency, responsibility. It's very difficult to know who is responsible, and oversight gets lost.
Now, the county gets into the prison business because it expects to make a profit by doing that and maybe to increase employment for its residents. But have the counties been actually making profits? Has this been a profitable enterprise?
I wouldn't call them profits. They're sold as economic development projects, and they're sold by private prison consultants who go around the country. They scour the country for small towns looking for someone in the town, in many cases in the Southwest, a Texas Ranger, a prominent Texas Ranger, or a sheriff, or an economic development guy, and sell that project to him. He sells it to the county as an economic development project that's going to bring some revenues into the county, generally from $1 to $2 per inmate, and jobs that would be created in their town. And they also make all sorts of other promises about indirect benefits that's going to bring other businesses and so on. So these counties are desperate. They don't want to raise taxes. They don't have much of a tax base. And join this with very little knowledge. And with this very little knowledge, they don't track it. They can't even find the contracts. They don't know how long the financing goes on. They don't know what interest rate it is. And I've gone into the basements of these county courthouses looking for the contracts with the U.S. Marshals Service or ICE or the Bureau of Prisons. They can't even find the contract. They kind of wipe their hands. They feel like it's all going to be taken care of by the private prison companies that have arranged the financing and operate the prisons, and then are content to get their $1 to $2 a day.
So is it paying off for the small counties that are taking on these prisons?
Yes and no. They are finding that the cost of these prisons are much higher than that they were told, that they have to maintain them. So when the roof goes bad, that they're responsible for replacing the roof. When the prisoners are using more water than expected, that they have to create new water projects. And nobody is looking at long-term out. These bonds that finance the prisons are 20 to 25 years at very high interest rates because they're tax-exempt and because of something that we hadn't mentioned. These are speculative prisons, meaning there's no contract with the federal government to provide a certain number of prisoners, so that it's a very high cost of financing. And if, as has been the case in a number of counties, the federal government drops out for any number of reasons, then the counties are stuck with a high debt and with lots of costs that they've incurred.
One of the problems that you've written about facing the immigrants and illegal aliens in these prisons is that many of them have been transferred thousands of miles from where they were arrested. And that creates a lot of problems both for the prisoner and for the family of the prisoner. Can you describe what those transfers are like and why they're happening?
Well, I asked a warden of one of the prisoners about that, saying that it's just basic common courtesy just to have these people have some contact with their family, with religious workers, with people from the community. And what he said is that particularly about the issue of being far from home, this was at a prison in New Mexico. These people have left their home. We're in the business of sending them back. And I had pointed out that some of these prisoners were from Maine, from Boston, from New York, and here they were in a very isolated part of New Mexico with no human contact. So the attitude is that these people have no human rights in the sense and have no need for them, and we're happy. They should be happy because we're sending them back to their home. It is a problem in terms of these transfers because it's very common that they pick them up everywhere in the country. They have these massive detention centers and prisons along the border where they're isolated in small communities. They don't have to pay the kind of per diems that they would have in major cities, but they have no access to lawyers, no access to family members. It's tragic.
And some of these people are people who've been living in the United States for many years, so like this has kind of become their home, even if it's not their legal home.
Oh, yes. You go to an immigration court, and you'll find that a common language is Spanish, but that maybe a third of immigrants don't speak Spanish, that are being sent back to Mexico or Honduras or El Salvador, have been here since they were children, teenagers, and are being sent back to a country that they're not familiar with, all their family members are here. I mean, what I found is that they're asking to be deported quickly. They're angry. They're frustrated that it's taking so long to get deported. And the reason is not to get back to their home in Mexico or El Salvador, but so that they can be deported. As soon as they're deported, to come back to the United States where their wives are, their children, their husbands. And so with all the security measures, all the penalties, all the imprisonment, they feel that they have no choice because their lives are here, their families are here, their livelihood is here in the United States.
Are families told when one of their family members is being transferred from a local prison to a prison hundreds or thousands of miles away?
No, well, the inmates themselves are not told. They're rounded up and, you know, generally oftentimes at night they're put into buses. They don't know where they're going. They don't know why they're going. And their lawyers are not told. Their family members are not told. Within the U.S. Marshal Service system, that's very difficult because there is no way to find a prisoner. ICE is trying to do something to have a locator system so that you can find out where your loved one is. But with the U.S. Marshal Service, that's not the case. So they can be sent from East Coast, West Coast, and land up in what is commonly by the cities and counties who own these prisons called the middle of nowhere. And they don't even know who is holding them, which is really, really fascinating, because that their experience, the people who are holding them are private security companies who transport them. They go to a private prison with a flag of the major prison corporation flying above that. The guards wear uniforms with the insignia of these private prison corporations. And it's possible that they can be transferred not only within the same system, say the system of Department of Homeland Security will transfer them. And they have the Department of Homeland Security even has a term that I guess they thought humorous, Operation Reservation Guaranteed, so that if they pick up someone and they feel like they don't have a place for them in a facility, a detention center in Virginia, they will transfer them at our expense to a detention center in West Texas or New Mexico or California, and not considering any expense, just to make sure that that person has what they call a bed, this operation reservation guaranteed.
What have you learned about conditions inside these prisons?
I started out looking just at the infrastructure of these prisons, just to figure out how this outsourcing system worked. So I was in this town of Pecos looking, trying to find the contracts that set up these prisons, with, in this case, the Bureau of Prisons with the county. And the county clerk didn't have it. She said she doesn't know where the contract is. So I'm just going through all the filing cabinets there. She says, well, if you ever find it, let me know. But just at that time, there was another riot, and she was saying that the prison is burning again. And it was that case that riot in Pecos, a town in West Texas, that got me more interested in the conditions inside the prison, particularly the case of one man, Jesus Manuel Galindo, who died. And the riot there was basically a solidarity demonstration by other prisoners who were saying that we cannot take these kind of medical conditions any longer. And what those conditions are is that they have no infirmary, and this is a prison for 3,700 criminal aliens. None of them are violent. Most of them are there in immigration violations. There's no infirmary. If people like Jesus had a medical problem, he's put under observation. But since there's no infirmary, he's put in solitary, where there's supposedly observation. It's called the secure housing unit. And in that secure housing unit, a guard is supposed to pass by every 30 minutes. And according to his mom and his dad and his brother, who I've talked to, that did not happen. He was not getting his proper medication, and he was concerned that he was going to die. He was afraid. And the letters he wrote in the last
days. Well, he had an underlying medical condition.
Yes, he had severe epilepsy, as the prison knew. His mother repeatedly called the prison and insisted that he get this medication. The prison, in this case, a GEO group, which ran the prison, was not giving him that medication. And he was, as he described in the letter, you know, I'm all beat up, and this is from thrashing around and epileptic seizures, but they put him in there because of observation. When he was in, this was, you know, actually it was about a year ago, and he thought that he was going to be out. He told his mom he would be out on December 12th. Because that's what he was told, and that's what he sort of believed. And December 12th was the anniversary of the Lady of Guadalupe, who many of the Mexican prisoners is a national saint, a patron. And he thought that he'd be out that day. It turned out that he died on the morning of December 12th. The prison didn't find him till 5 hours after he had died, and they took him out in a body bag, and that's when the other prisoners revolted. And it wasn't because they were demanding something for themselves, or they just were so outraged that these conditions exist that someone who had a severe medical condition was put into solitary, which is commonly called the hole by the inmates.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, he was put into solitary because he had a medical condition that needed to be monitored, but it wasn't monitored in solitary, so he died there.
That's right. That's exactly right. And there was no alternative in terms of medical observation because the prison did not have one. Now that there was a riot, that the Bureau of Prisons and the county, which owns the prison, and GEO Group, which operates the prison, is going to put an infirmary in. And actually, they all talked about could they get away with not putting an infirmary. And it was the county judge who said, "Well, this is why we had all the problems in the first place. These guys were sick; they had did nothing wrong. They rioted because they were put into solitary. We have to do something about this."
Many of the prisons you've been investigating along the southwest border of the United States are run by two of the biggest private prison companies in America, CCA, which is the Corrections Corporation of America, and the GEO Group. Tell us something about these two companies.
Well, private prisons didn't always exist in the United States. In the 1980s, both of these companies got their start through what was then the Immigration and Naturalization Service, taking care of immigrants, that they got contracts from the Reagan administration to hold immigrants. And from there, their private prison business grew. And then in the late 1990s, when they had built many speculative prisons and were finding that they were not enough, that the crime rates were not as high as that they had hoped, and the federal government came in and with the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Marshals Service, previously it was just the Immigration Service, contracted them, sometimes with county governments, sometimes directly, to build new prisons for immigrants. And that really solved a big financial crisis that they were facing. Their stock was plummeting then. In the last 8 years, they've experienced record profits because of this continued flow, rising flow of immigrants from these three agencies that we've talked about. It is 40 to 45% of their business is holding outsourced immigrants.
And the GEO Group, one of the companies that you're talking about, they used to be Wack and Hut. Wack and Hut used to do a lot of private security.
That's right. They were doing private security in the 80s, and then they got into the private prison business. Wack and Hut still exists, but it's apart from GEO. And Wack and Hut is another corporation that figures into this mix. So a prisoner will generally be transported by Wack and Hut. Wack and Hut is a major contractor for the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice. You see all over the Southwest, you see their buses everywhere and transporting prisoners. And these are the people, as we talked earlier about the transfers, who handle all of these transfers that are done for no rhyme or reason, generally because they want them in a place that is more remote, logistically better, nearer the border, that they can eventually deport them, and are in a prison with all other criminal aliens.
So some people will know the name Wack and Hut because they do a lot of private security. Some people will recognize the name Wack and Hut because it was Wack and Hut employees who were hired to guard the embassy in Afghanistan, and were later, there were photos discovered of them drunk and, as they're calling, sexual poses. So did that have repercussions for the part of Wack and Hut that deals with transporting prisoners? Did that call into question the reliability or professionalism of the company?
No. The follow-up question is, why not? I don't know. There is very little oversight, that they keep on renewing these contracts despite major abuses. And yes, Wack and Hut is part of Armor Group, does guard that embassy, and there were those problems. But these problems are not particular to Afghanistan, that there are problems throughout this prison system of having low-paid, generally, correctional security officers responsible for this, with very little training, very little professionalism, and you see abuses. And in fact, we're talking about the prison in Pecos, that in the last 6 months, more than a dozen of the correctional staff have been indicted for various crimes of bringing in drugs or other illegal items into the prison.
What questions do you think we should be asking ourselves as a society about the new laws for legal and illegal aliens and the prisons that hold people who are convicted of breaking those laws?
Back in the late 1990s, we created the Office of Federal Detention Trustee that was supposed to coordinate all of this detention and look out for abuses, provide oversight. That has not happened since soon after this was created. The Department of Homeland Security was created, and that whole system fell apart. So the questions that I'm asking, the questions that many are asking, were being asked in the 1990s, and we came up with a solution, and it never took effect. I think a major question, too, is the cost. We're spending, as a country, $4 billion just in the detention and imprisonment of nonviolent immigrants who are convicted mainly of immigration violations. Is this the way, a good way to spend our money? And then what happens to the families of these immigrants who are taking away from their communities and their family life? That it's very destructive. So there's an economic impact there. I think economic questions need to be asked. They're not being asked because when it comes to immigrants, every year the budget for Department of Justice and Homeland Security arises for immigrant crackdown issues. Can we afford this? Is it good for our nation?
Well, Tom Barry, I want to thank you very much for joining us. I know you had to drive through a lot of snow and wind to get from your home to the studio KTEP in El Paso where you spoke to us from. I want to thank you for the effort. Thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for being interested in this issue. Appreciate it.
Tom Barry is a senior analyst at the Center for Immigration Policy, where he directs the Trans Border Project. He writes the blog Borderlines. His article on immigration prisons is in the current edition of Boston Review. Susan Boyle became an overnight sensation after her April performance on Britain's Got Talent, singing I Dreamed a Dream from Les Mis. The 48-year-old Scottish singer released her first album on November 23rd. Since then, it's sold 5 million copies worldwide and has stayed on top of the charts. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by, when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I prayed that God would be forgiving. Then I was
the rapid rise of Susan Boyle illustrates a pop culture truism. No piece of pop music stands by itself. We also bring to any judgment of the work the image and whatever we know about the person singing it. In Boyle's case, we had a middle-aged woman whose dowdy, unpolished presentation was belied by the confident power of her voice. Her media breakthrough was at least as important as her ability. Appearing on Britain's Got Talent before three judges and an audience snickering and ready to jeer, Susan Boyle shamed and cowed the audience with the sheer strength of her vocal power.
When I was a child, I could see the wind in the trees, and I heard a song in the breeze. It was there singing now my name.
It takes a lot to tamp down the sarcasm of Simon Cowell, one of the Britain's Got Talent judges, but Boyle did that and more. She ushered in, however briefly, a moment in which glitz and irony were pushed aside. There was an overwhelming worldwide response to YouTube viewings of not just Boyle's singing, but also her humble comments about living in Scotland with her cat and, before her death in 2007, her mother. People professed not mere admiration, but love for Susan Boyle. She single-handedly, overnight, altered the tone of shows such as America's Got Talent. Suddenly, tears of gratitude were popping from the eyes of Judge Sharon Osbourne at the mere sound of a child contestant hitting a high note with precision. The feeling was, Boyle is real. In this sense, Susan Boyle was as much a benefactor of the cult of authenticity as Bruce Springsteen has been.
Oh, I could hide 'neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings. 6 o'clock alarm would never ring. wipe the sleep out of my eyes. The tears of yesterday don't mean a thing. Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream?
And so now we have Susan Boyle's debut album, inevitably called I Dreamed a Dream. It showcases her clear, surging voice with tasteful, minimal orchestral accompaniment. The songs here don't test or twist her, but then her instantly massive audience doesn't want to hear Susan Boyle pushed into slickness or cool song choices. The biggest gamble Boyle takes is in covering the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses, and she pulls it off. She renders the song exactly what she calls it in her liner note comments, a, quote, emotional release.
Childhood living, it's easy to do. The things that you wanted, well, I bought them for you. Graceless lady, you know who I am. You know I can't let you. Slide through my hands. Wild horses.
There's no humor or swing in Boyle's phrasing, no evidence despite a few song choices that she's been influenced by anything in the rock music era. Her album includes two hymns, a Christmas carol, and Broadway musical theater. In addition to I Dreamed a Dream, a version of Cry Me a River with all of that composition's rueful vengeance drained off. At her best, she makes Wild Horses, the Madonna song You'll See, and the Skeeter Davis hit End of the World into anthems of perseverance. This is the kind of debut that confirms Boyle's talent. Whether she can move beyond this into an interesting singer with a wider range of emotional concerns remains to be heard. For now, she's giving her fans what they want, but she'll inevitably have to give them something that will challenge both her audience and herself.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Susan Boyle's new album, I Dreamed a Dream. If you're looking for gifts for the holiday season, our TV critic David Bianculli has a few suggestions. Recently released DVD sets of old and new TV shows. Match the right shows to the right recipients, he suggests, and you're giving hours and hours of pleasure.
The TV shows on DVD landscape is changing. The economy is down, stores have less shelf space, and producers are being more cautious about what and how much they release into the marketplace. And year after year, there are some omissions that frustrate me to no end. Where, oh where, is the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd with Blair Brown? Where are all those missing seasons of St. Elsewhere? But rather than complain like Scrooge about what's not around this year, I'm here to celebrate what is. There are a few releases I didn't ever expect to see on DVD, and some special complete sets that would make great gifts for the right person. So here we go. A fast romp through my recommended DVD holiday list, starting with a very welcome voice from TV's distant past.
Hello, I'm Charles Kuralt. We're off again to meet a few people on the back roads of America. These are people you know, not from the front pages. They've never been on the front pages. There are people you know from next door and down the block. Their stories are some of my favorites from 25 years on the road.
If you don't recognize that voice, you won't be as excited about Acorn Media's On the Road with Charles Kuralt set as you should be. Beginning in the late 60s, Kuralt and his crew traveled across America in a motorhome, stopping in small towns in search of small but uplifting stories for CBS. It's the kind of TV they really, truly don't make anymore. and they're as sweetly nostalgic to watch now, after all these years, as an old Norman Rockwell painting. Another new DVD set collects TV that is even older. The Golden Age of Television was a PBS series that ran about 25 years ago, presenting a small but stellar collection of live TV dramas that had been broadcast in primetime some 25 years before that. So we're talking old. But we're also talking great. Patterns and Requiem for a Heavyweight by Rod Serling. Bang the Drum Slowly with Paul Newman. The Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon. And, from 1953, the first Golden Age drama to realize the full potential of live TV, Paddy Chayefsky's Marty. Rod Steiger starred in that drama as a lonely middle-aged butcher who goes to a local dance hall in search of a possible date. He meets a woman there, all right, another lonely outcast whom he's just watched being dumped by her date in favor of someone more attractive. Marty asks the woman to dance, and they slowly, quietly connect. It's a wonderful, intimate scene, made even greater when you realize the young woman playing opposite Rod Steiger is Nancy Marchand, who would end up playing Tony Soprano's horrible mother, Livia, on The Sopranos.
I guess I can recognize pain a mile off, you know. My brothers and sisters are always saying to me what a good-hearted guy I am. You know, you don't get to be good-hearted. My accents, you got to be kicked around long enough and hard enough, and then you get to be like a professor of pain, you know. So I know exactly how you feel. And I want to tell you something else, too. I'm having a very, very good time tonight. I'm enjoying myself, so you see. You're not such a dog as you think you are.
I'm having a good time, too.
Well, you see, that means I'm not such a dog as you think I am.
Oh, I think you're a very nice guy.
This is the first time this retrospective has been released on DVD, and it comes from Criterion, so it's the full treatment. Beautiful transfers, beautiful packaging, even an informative booklet. For anyone who cares about TV's salad days, it's the perfect gift. For slightly younger TV fans, though, there are other choices. BBC Video has just released remastered complete series editions of two fabulously funny British comedy classics, loaded with new interviews and other bonus material. One is Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson, showing every series and movie incarnation of that bizarre character study. And the other is Fawlty Towers with John Cleese, which I still consider one of the funniest TV series ever made. Another quirky comedy, closer to home, is the complete series DVD set from Shout Factory of It's Gary Shandling's Show. This is the show Shandling did for cable before The Larry Sanders Show, and the entire conceit of the series was an ahead-of-its-time satire of reality television. Even the theme song was hyper-aware of itself.
This is the theme to Gary's show, the theme to Gary's show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary's show?
Other new complete series sets this year include the sci-fi series Farscape from A&E, a terrifically inventive and entertaining series finally collected in one place. And, perhaps the year's biggest treat of all, Fox Home Entertainment's nicely packaged complete series set of Ally McBeal. This is the set that not only holds up, but seems just as fresh as before. Fans of writer-producer David E. Kelley or of Brothers and Sisters star Calista Flockhart will be especially happy with this one. And finally, there's Time Life Video's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum collection, which gathers induction speeches, performances, and jams from the Hall of Fame's entire history, including many that have never been televised anywhere. The DVDs are set up so you can watch them in their entirety or just go straight from one song to another. And Time Life gives you another valuable option as well. The set comes as a 9-disc mammoth offering on the internet, or with the first 3 discs, loaded with great music, available as a smaller, more affordable set in stores. That's where you'll hear, among other things, Crosby, Stills, and Nash with Tom Petty performing Buffalo Springfield's classic, For What It's Worth. And for what it's worth, I recommend this set and all the others I mentioned as being eminently gift-worthy.
David Bianculli writes TVWorthWatching.com, teaches TV and film at Rowan University, and is the author of the new book, Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.